afternoon, everyone. You are listening to Open Source's Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me today is, well, not Scotty Hertz. He is in Scotland looking for the Loch Ness Monster or whatever he does when he's not doing Open Source's stuff. So I am flying solo for the next couple of weeks, so literally anything can happen as I am demonstrably unqualified to run the studio. But anyway, Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen, and you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So today I'm going to talk about living with climate change, and that is with Barry Smit. He is an emeritus professor here at the University of Guelph, and we are going to bring his incredible expertise to bear on all those powerful hurricanes in the Atlantic, including Irma, which is presently bearing down on Florida. How is climate change altering our world, and can we do anything about it, or are we just going to have to cope and adapt? That will be at the bottom of the hour after the break. But first, I am very pleased to welcome back Ward 6 Councillor Mark McKinnon. Welcome back to the show. It's been a while since we had you on.
Yeah, thanks very much, Adam. I appreciate being back.
How was your summer vacation, may I ask?
It wasn't bad. It wasn't a lot of a vacation. A lot of work when you're an entrepreneur and working. And I was the acting mayor for the month of August. So I had a few things I was filling in for that. And then, of course, with family as well. Need to keep the kids occupied as much as you can. So it wasn't a lot of vacationing, but we did some mini trips. And so that was
nice.
Right.
Yeah, I did note that. I was looking at Twitter trying to figure out what we were going to talk about. You were the acting mayor, though, for the Dwarf Games, the World Dwarf Games. That was a huge event here.
Yeah, that was really neat to be able to go to the opening ceremonies and bring the greetings from the city on behalf of the mayor and council for that, and just, you know, watching them all walk in and just the amazing time that they were going to have during that time. Went to the party that was at the street mm-hmm. parties on the Thursday night, went to that as well to give greetings. So it was really nice. Not always are there exciting things that happen whenever I'm the acting mayor, but it was really good time.
I was going to say Dan got hometown hockey earlier this year. He was the acting mayor for hometown hockey. So
yeah, so you got a big one too.
Do they let you wear the chain when you're acting mayor?
No, that's locked up. No. Okay. we don't touch that. Cam wouldn't be too happy with that, I think. So,
well, another thing I wanted to point out, I saw that Facebook picture of you, you know, from younger days.
No.
You had the beard, and
yes.
it was quite something. I had to look at it for a solid minute before I was like, yeah, that is Mark McKinnon.
But yeah, it was a while ago. I just thought
of that because it seemed like everyone's growing the summer beards there, but I did notice Cam shaved off his before,
yes,
before
indeed.
Getting back to business. James did not.
No.
let's talk about some serious stuff, we'll try and talk seriously.
That's all council stuff is serious.
Absolutely. I think the big thing happening this week is there are a couple of things, and I think particular reference to your ward is one is schools back. You have a lot of students in your ward. A lot of people, once they move off campus, usually find their way further south and into student housing. Well, that's not student housing, but it's student, you know, sort of. Two students.
Yeah, we call it purpose-built housing.
Purpose-built.
Some of that. As well, of course, all the regular condos that people rent and basement apartments and full houses, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, certainly Ward 6, we get a large portion of it. That, and I'm not sure who has more, 5 or 6, but I think with all the development going on in 6, if we're not past 5 now, we may be in the future.
I think that's a safe bet. And then along with that is transit. You know, the new routes have been, and schedules were released this week. I think... Again, your area is particularly impacted because there's been a particular emphasis put on making sure people aren't being left behind on Gordon Street.
Yeah, in particular, some huge benefits for Ward 6 residents living there, the students or just regular residents that live here year-round. In the past, council has approved development, mm-hmm. New buildings and whatnot, as we're intensifying, and that's certainly fine. But unfortunately, you can't approve new developments without also approving transit, the way to get there. And council, for the past five, six, 7 years, hasn't really made that investment in the transit, although we're happy to have the buildings go up and full of students or other people at the same time. We're not willing to move them. So the realignment that was done within the current budget envelope, there was no increase. What it was, the GM, Mike Spicer, came in and, with his expertise, did a lot of realignment of the different transit systems, and particularly the 99 Main Line, which did predate him coming in as a concept.
Right.
And it was pushed back a while from when I thought it was going to come in. But that main line going up and down Gordon, Norfolk, all the way up to Walmart from Clare Road, straight through the city, running every 10 minutes. That is spectacular. So I don't want to see any more people waiting on the side of the road as bus after bus drives by because they're all full and students are being late to class. So, no, it's wonderful that the transit changes, not just the main line in the Ward 6. There's other great changes as well. What we're doing is right-sizing the transit, taking the underserviced routes that didn't have a lot of people riding them and maybe altering those routes in order to put capacity where it's more needed, like the main line.
Yeah, and I was curious because I was on the inaugural the inaugural 99 on Sunday. James Gordon, who is Ward 2 counselor, was there, and he was talking about how he's gotten a lot of negative feedback. A lot of seniors live in his area, so A, set in their ways, B, that the changes have not really reached people in that area, or they've seen a reduction in service. You know, maybe peak service has been taken away on a couple of routes. But I think your ward is probably an example of where people are probably more pleased with the expanded service. And I'm wondering about what feedback you've gotten from your constituents.
Yeah, it hasn't been so much yet. It's still very new for some people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think in the end, a lot of the stops are in the same location or very close by. Mm-hmm. So someone who last year was living in a residence and stepped out and got a bus. And then this year, they're doing the exact same thing. The difference is it's every 10 minutes now, or it's coming a little more frequently. I've heard from a few residents because they've changed the direction on some of the buses, where bus stops used to be on one side of the road, and maybe they're now on the other side. And I've heard some residents say, you know, that's now in front of my house, that stop, and there's going to be garbage issues. There's going to be noise issues from buses idling or from people standing around waiting for the bus. And I certainly understand that that is a concern when you're used to a certain way.
Right.
And then things change and suddenly things are different. It is an inconvenience. And talking with transit about it, it seems like this is the right decision. No one's going to be 100% pleased with everything that's done. But in the end, we have to look at not the individual, but the community as the whole. And so as a whole, this is very positive changes. Yes, individual people may be impacted, and that is unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a lot we can do if we want to avoid impacting absolutely anyone, but just impact them, everyone, positively. Unfortunately, it just can't happen. That's just not a system that we can have. So
right.
I've heard a little bit of feedback. Most of it's been positive, a little bit negative. But I think certainly the South End, which has an incredible growth of population, we are getting some of the buses and some of the realignments that really benefit the residents there.
Yeah, and I would note that the buses go past the Pergola Commons, those two plazas there on the corners of Clare that are kitty corner from each other, which is something that I think was badly needed, because otherwise you get dropped off like a block over and have to, you know, walk through parking lots and, you know, residential streets in order to get to those shops and services.
No, absolutely. In fact, there's a place on in the Pergolas area between the LCBO and the Scotiabank, I believe it is, or CIBC. It is Scotiabank. There's an area that was undeveloped, and it was set aside as a potential for maybe a transit hub at some point in the future. So the whole area is being developed, except for this one little area, and no one's quite sure what that was for. But I've seen some of the earlier plans, and yeah, there's a potential that some sort of transit hub may be put in there once the Clare Multi-Secondary Plan gets developed, and there's a lot more development going further down to the edge of the city.
That recently had a big benchmark. It came back to council the plan for the area south of Clare, pretty much the south of Clare to where the city limit is.
That's right, yeah. Clare to Maltby, and then effectively from Victoria to Gordon is kind of the main development area. And that's a huge untapped area. Geographically, it's probably the largest or the second largest next to the Guelph Innovation District on York Road. But of course, in that, the Clare Maltby area, there's a lot of protected significant wetlands, for example. So it's not all going to be developed, but that is a next big place, and we have to take a look at that. And we're going to be doing the secondary plan over the next couple of years to determine how we should be developing that forward. And say 10 years in the future, there's going to be a lot more residents going further south in the city.
Mm-hmm. It might be Ward 7 in the not too distant future. That's another subject altogether. I wanted to address this because it's kind of in the news, and we were talking about it a little bit before the show, but the first service review is coming back with an interim report on Monday the 18th, so a week from this coming Monday. And I know there was a lot of concern at the Labor Day picnic with some of the outside workers that this was going to be a privatization, or there was going to be maybe some suggestion that privatization was going to come up, although it seems like that may have been... I don't want to say chicken littleism, but you know, it seems like maybe they were worried for nothing because the report was released today to the public, and certainly not to the shock of the workers, and probably not to the shock of many people in town. Solid waste is doing pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, certainly everyone wants to make sure that they don't have direct impact on themselves. I mean, that makes total sense. But when we're looking at from council, from a managing the city point of view, nothing can be off the table. All options have to be there. And that could include different service delivery, privatization, increasing our current delivery, you know, enhancing services. Everything should be on the table. And the report is very preliminary. In fact, it's almost breaking news today, the fact that it just was released at 1 o'clock today. So
yeah,
this is very timely. I mean, of the six different areas of solid waste, six of them were reviewed and studied. And five of them are either at or above the comparable municipalities in terms of the effectiveness, efficiency, and cost valuation. So there's only one area that's looking like it's a little bit of a problem, and that's something that we need to address, specifically what the solutions are going to be. It's way too early in the process for that. This is just the preliminary stuff that's come out. And yeah, obviously no one wants to be affected, but in the end, we owe the city the responsibility to do the best thing and to get the most value for the dollar, as well as to provide the best service for the city at a level that the majority of residents are going to be comfortable with. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that come forward and hearing the report more fully on that.
I know Mayor Guthrie has made media statements similar to that, but the concern is that maybe a majority of council has an appetite for privatization, that this is maybe it's an ideological thing, and that's probably – it may be incorrect, but, you know, how do you feel about privatizing?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in general, ideology and politics don't mix very well. I mean, unfortunately, they're often there. But I think as a good centrist that I am, I think every issue needs to be looked at individually, analyzed, nothing held back, nothing forbidden. And then the best decisions have to be made going forward. So am I pro-privatization? No, but I'm not also against privatization. Staff recommendations they weigh very heavily on my decisions because they're the professionals. They're working this day in and day out. None of the counselors are working in solid waste.
Right.
Mayor Guthrie, he is full-time, and he has more exposure to the stuff that all the counselors do who are part-time. But even a full-time city council member does not have the exposure that the staff do who are there day in and day out. And so if they do a review and they recommend X, Y, or Z, then I think it's behoven on council to take a serious look at those options to see which ones is best going forward and not bow to an ideology that says, oh, we can't do X, we can't do Y because it's the wrong thing to do. I think we have to look to say what is the best for the city, and that could be a number of different options. And I have no preconceived notions of what they should be. I'm a big proponent of doing the service reviews or a rationalization and have been for a number of years because I think, you know, until you look within, until you examine, you don't know what the problems are until you look for those problems.
Right. And we'll note that in the report, there's no recommendations. This is an information report that meant an opportunity for council to ask follow-up questions about the work that's been done so far and the work that's left to be done. And the one area we were talking about, the Waste Innovation Resource Center, I think it's been fairly well known that there have been problems with that for some time. and it was talked about at the committee meeting on Tuesday. And I'm just curious in terms of your thoughts. And, you know, we're obviously waiting for the consultants and the auditors to come back with the complete list of where things are going wrong. But this has been an albatross for a while.
It really has. It's hung over this council in particular. Not to say that, you know, things cropped up on this council and right. all the problems happen. These aren't recent problems. They've been around for a while. Some of them are more sensitive than others in terms of what the issues are. But what it comes down to is we have an expense issue and we have a spending issue, and maybe we're not having an efficiency issue that goes along with those. And so, yeah, I know that we have great staff working on it now. If we were to go back numerous years compared to what we have now, I think we're in a vastly superior position with the staff we have and the organizational structure that we have. And I'm very confident that we're going to come up with the best solution. There's no right solution. There's no free solution. But in terms of what the best solution is for the city, I definitely think we're going to be moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm. You don't have your own ideas in terms of... And first of all, if you're just coming into the issue, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around
this
facility that's, you know, been losing millions every year. And Christine Billings brought this up at the meeting on Tuesday, that this is a kind of a systemic problem. Every year there's a budget. Every year it goes over budget. And it is a curious thing, you know, that it's almost expected now. But then every quarter report, council's still kind of caught in the red on that.
Yeah, well, as I use the analogy, I guess, peeling back the onion, as we're seeing more and more problems, we thought, oh, here's the problem. We've identified it. We've fixed that problem. Great. Yeah. And then a new one crops up that we didn't know about. Particularly with solid waste, and in a lot of the aspects of city budgeting, but with solid waste in particular, council is very hard on staff to try to keep costs low and
right.
keep costs manageable. And so I know that staff is budgeting very, very tightly. They could come in and say, well, we need X millions of dollars to do this correctly. Mm. And that gives them a bit of padding room. And so if they went a little bit over what their expectations are, they'd still be within budget.
Right.
But that's not what's happening. I think they're budgeting as tightly as possible to try to get a number at the end of the year during budget season that's as conservative, as reasonable as they think it might be if everything goes well, without adding in all the extra what-if contingencies.
Right.
And so they're not padding the budget by an extra million or two of just in case. So when something does happen, whether it's a fire and we lose recyclables,
right.
or we have a bad contract and we're a little bit burned by that, or no contract for some issues, or in the case of Waterloo Region, that they started increasing their amount of tonnage that they're sending us for processing.
Right.
And they're not budgeted for because we're budgeting very, very tightly. Staff, I think, does an excellent job of giving us the lowest number. But it's, in many ways, it's best case scenario. They're not giving us the disaster scenarios, because if they were, the tax increases would be much higher if we added in that padding. And that would avoid negative variances. But, you know, so it's negative variance isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
If there's a problem, then we can obviously correct it. But what a negative variance may indicate is that the base budget that we had was pretty conservative and was pretty tight, and maybe we just went over a little bit because of unforeseen circumstances. But it means that the taxpayers weren't paying more to begin with than they thought they should have.
Here's a philosophical question. Is it better to have a budget and it goes maybe $500,000 over and it shows you sort of where it has to be increased? Or is it better that you add that $500,000 or another million and then it comes back at the end of the year and you didn't spend that entire budget?
Yeah, precisely. I mean, ask people when they file their taxes.
Right.
Would they prefer an extra $50 coming out of their taxes every paycheck so that at the end of the year they get a refund? Or did they want to have more money on a weekly basis and then maybe at the end of the year they owe $1,000? So it is a good question. I mean, and people have different philosophies on it. Personally, what I would like to see is the budgets be a little more loose so that we can put more towards reserves. And that's one of the things that came up in the discussion this week. And I've been very big on reserves since I got on council, that our reserves are underfunded and we got to start topping up reserves. And if we're too conservative on what our budgeting is, then we'll never get a chance to add some stuff into the reserve unless we make a purposeful addition, which is, you know, the infrastructure fund, for example. We're purposely making a dedicated allocation to a reserve fund based on the fact that we're going to have some costs. So does that need to happen for stormwater, solid waste, or other issues? Yeah, maybe it does. I think we're doing a good job, but we're not done, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
We're not perfect.
I do want to get to budget, but I do want to also touch on NISCA, because I know this is a point of contention in your area in terms of the redevelopment of that road and the bridge. Where does that stand right now?
Yeah, great question. So there's not a lot of contention about the bridge right now because it's closed.
Yeah.
And so no one is using it.
Yeah.
The plans are still going forward. There's no change on the plans to make it a proper two-lane road to go with the two-lane bridge and do some redevelopment in that area to make sure that is safe and is up to modern provincial standards. The bigger issue that's coming up recently has been the development of the GRCA lands in the nearby area.
Right.
Should there be development in an area where is right next to protected or at very least culturally significant areas and lands?
Yeah.
Some people prefer no more development in the area. Some people are thinking, well, we got to develop, and you know that's a lot of land that we have, so why don't we do some developments there? And that is a bigger issue right now. And I don't think the bridge has kind of been a little quiet just because there's nothing anyone can do at this point. It's closed, and we're still in the pre-development process before we actually get the new bridge constructed.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The GRCA's in a gathering feedback right now about potential development in that area.
Yeah, I think their big thing right now is getting some feedback. As with all big government organizations, as they operate, there's going to be community consultation process, and a lot of the people don't want to see the GRCA sell any lands to developers to put up mid-rise, high-rise, town row houses, whatever it may be, because that area right now has no development on it, and a lot of people would prefer that would be the case. It's not unique to the GRCA lands around NISCA. A lot of people would prefer seeing no development anywhere else in Guelph because people don't like development typically, other than the developers or the people that want places to live. And the people that want more places to live and complain about Guelph not having enough housing or affordable housing or housing options and why we're having skyrocketing prices because our inventory is so low.
Yeah.
Those people may want places, but there's no right solution. What it comes down to is the GRCA has to do their process. At some point, the city, if it gets to a development point of view, we do our process, and then the developers do their process as well.
I remember this time last year, I think it was Guelph Today, did a little piece that talked to every councillor about what the budget process that year was going to look like. I think it was half and half in terms of it was going to be difficult versus not very difficult. I would add, though, that this year is going to be different because it's the last budget before an election. So is it going to be difficult this year?
It's a great question. I don't think it's going to be nearly as difficult as previous years. The big one last year, to me, was the infrastructure fund, to making sure that we got that secured, got that in place. I'm very, very happy that we managed to get that 1% because I think it's really important for the city. So what are some of the big issues this year? I'm pretty sure we're going to have an ask from transit. It would certainly make sense. They've done a lot with the realignment within their budget envelope, but they're probably going to ask for some more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, can we do even better with a little bit more money? There'll be, I already know of a few extra things that's going to come up. For example, security. I know that the city's staff is looking for a couple of security officers to take the pressure off of bylaw and to make a more safe and enjoyable workplace for our workers. So that issue has come up. There's a few issues, but it's interesting. A lot of the big ones, I mean, last year when we had not only just the infrastructure fund, but we also had when we went from the stormwater management from a tax-based into a more utility like we pay for water and wastewater, those two big things happened last year. So, yeah, there's always going to be discussion about should we add this new employment X or Y, whether it's an arborist or a security guard or something else. There's always going to be those discussions. But a lot of the really big things, I think, were done last year. And I think this year will be easier. And of course, because it's leading up to an election cycle, I'm sure a lot of politicians wouldn't mind looking good to their residents. It's not something that I concern myself with. I take every budget as it is and each item as they need to be looked at. But I think it will be probably a little less combative, perhaps, than previous years, I would think.
Well, from your lips to Cam's ears, what else are you looking forward to in the fall? What's on your agenda? What are you looking to get done?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, for me, I need to interact with staff a little bit more on interfacing. The affordable bus pass is still something I'm very passionate about. Mm. 2 years ago, I was bringing up some motions to try to realign some of the affordable bus pass, make it even more affordable for people that are at the lower end of the incomes in our city. And we agreed to push it off a little bit. Well, last year, budget season, everything was up in the air with transit. We had a new GM come in. We had a new deputy CAO come in. So it was kind of an understanding that maybe we need to take a pause for a year. Let's work on our core essential things that we need to do. But going back this year, I would love to see us make some movement as council and some really positive direction on the affordable bus pass. I think there's a lot of people that can really benefit from getting that lowered. I don't see a reason why not. Our buses, in many ways, could use the extra capacity. And I think we can service the people who are under service right now in our community. And maybe then with that political will might not be so bad before an election season. If people want to look good and do some nice things, maybe this is the year to do it. So I'm hopeful that we can make some directions, some really positive directions there. Regarding most of the things of the budget, I mean, in many ways, I feel like last year was almost Christmas for a counselor that wanted to have responsible financial management going forward. Mm. A lot of it came last year, and that's great, whether it's the infrastructure fund or the stormwater management turning into a utility. So, yeah, I'm taking an eye on what's coming out. I'm looking forward to the full service review on this one. We're going to be doing an interim service review coming up shortly on transit as well. And so I'm certainly looking forward to seeing what they entail.
Don't forget the controversial boulevard maintenance service review. That's you're going to see some angry workers then, I think.
Well, that'll be a very short one, fortunately. It's not nearly as in-depth.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming by today. If people want to reach out to you, maybe add to your agenda for the fall in terms of issues, how can people find you?
Sure. Best way is always at my email. It's mark.mckinnon@guelph.ca is a great way to reach me. And, of course, I'm available on Twitter and Facebook at Ward 6 Mark as well.
Well, thanks again, and I'm glad to have you come by in studio, and we'll see you around the horseshoe in the next couple of weeks.
Thanks so much, Adam. Appreciate you being on.
And we're going to take a break here and play some very, very, very important public service announcements, and then a musical break, and then we'll come back with Barry Smith of the University of Guelph. We're going to talk about climate change. You're listening to Open Source of Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Hi, my name's Karen, and you're tuned into Guelph's volunteer-programmed campus and community radio station, CFRU 93.3 FM.
That is Harvey by the Electric Swing Circus, and that is from their album of the self-titled album, the Electric Swing Circus. So this is going to be a pre-recorded interview. I did it yesterday. It is with Barry Smith. He's an emeritus professor in the Department of Geography here at the U of G. Now, the title of the song, Harvey, I actually chose it because of Hurricane Harvey, which ravaged the Texas coast a couple of weeks ago. Now there's another storm called Hurricane Irma that is going to be hitting the Florida coast and has been battering islands in the Caribbean for the last couple of days. And so with these huge storms, I thought it behooved us to get a scientific perspective on climate change and trying to understand the changes, why we can't put the blame on these storms almost entirely on climate change, at least from a scientific perspective, but also how, you know, the climate change is also affecting the extremeness and the severity and the frequency of these storms as well. So Smith is really a great local expert on the subject. He was part of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the same one that shared the Nobel Peace Prize with former Vice President Al Gore in 2007. He was named to the Order of Ontario in 2013, And he is the holder of the Canada Research Chair in Global Environment Change for the last decade. And then last year, he was given the highest academic honor in the country by being inducted into the Royal Society of Canada. So this man knows his stuff, and he is going to share it with you. This is my interview with Barry Smit, Professor Emeritus at the U of G. To begin with, I want to kind of define some terms, because I think when we hear about these big storms, Sandy, Katrina, Irma, Harvey, and all that, climate scientists, and generally scientists in general, are very not eager to say, yes, this is A plus B equals C, or 1 plus 1 equals 2. So what they say instead is, you know, is that there is a strong correlation, not necessarily causation, but correlation. So just for, in terms of how you go about your work as a scientist, what are some of the determining factors you deal with, and why are you so careful to ride that line?
Well, hurricanes and storms and droughts at the other extreme,
right,
it's not enough water, they've always occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Climate is naturally variable from
right.
year to year. And with climate change, most of the scientific focus has been on change in norm and on temperature,
mm-hmm.
long term.
Mm-hmm.
And we recognize that within that, and that's well established, of course, that within that we still have variation from year to year, and we still have extremes.
Mm-hmm.
So these most recent extremes, Harvey and Katrina and the latest one, Irma, these extremes occur anyway.
Right.
But the role that climate change plays in them, or global warming, which is part of climate change, is that there's now a lot of confidence that that climate change intensifies these and maybe changes their frequency or their magnitude or their direction.
Right.
So small Pacific Island states have already documented that the hurricanes that they get, or cyclones as they call them,
mm-hmm.
that travel, have slightly changed their route. And this is to be expected because with climate change and global warming, we get changes in ocean temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ocean temperature that drives these storms.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we've always had storms. They're a natural part of our climate regime. But with climate change, we're changing the frequency of them, we're changing the intensity of them, and we're changing the, in some ways, the path of them. So in Atlantic Canada right now,
mm-hmm.
They're already changing their emergency response because they've seen that the storms that used to hit Florida and South Carolina and North Carolina, they're moving up that Atlantic coast
mm-hmm.
because the oceans are becoming warmer and their storms are traveling further north and being more intensified. So it's not that this storm is because of climate change, but climate change contributes to more intense and more frequent storms of the kind we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. Because people have noted the unusualness. You had Harvey a couple of weeks ago. Now Irma is plowing through the Caribbean, and Jose is kind of winding up right before that. So in a less climate change afflicted world, those storms might be less severe, more spaced out. It would still be usual that maybe every 4 or 5 years you would have a severe cycle like this, but the frequency, the intensity.
Exactly. We've always had storms, and there are storm seasons. The end of the summer, the ocean is warmed up. They generate these storms. Now we're getting the same storms we've already had, but we're getting them stronger and more frequent.
Mm-hmm. It seems like, in so much as weather has always been cyclical, it does seem like the cycle is now, in terms of intensities, here in Ontario, we're coming off what's been a rather moist summer, a more temperate summer. There wasn't a huge heat wave. There wasn't months of drought. In comparison to last year, where there was months of drought and huge heat waves, it seems that the other symptom is, of course, the weather is tending to go more to the extremes. And another thing I note, and I realize it's anecdotal, not necessarily the type of evidence you deal with, is that there's no spring anymore. There's no weeks where you go out in a jacket. It's like you're wearing your winter coat 1 week and you're wearing short sleeves the next week.
Well, we've had a distinctive summer this year, but I wouldn't look at a particular year as mm-hmm. evidence of anything to do with climate change.
Okay.
Because we always have variation year to year.
Mm-hmm.
For evidence of climate change, you need to look over not only decades, but many decades.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at that record, it's clear that climate change is with us.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you look at the at, at the obvious evidence, the Arctic ice. Every year there's less and less Arctic ice, mm-hmm. so that now ships can go through the Northwest Passage without an icebreaker. That hasn't been possible, not only in my lifetime, which is longer than yours, but for even longer than that. So, I mean, there's clear evidence of these things, but the month-to-month variations, the year-to-year, they're driven by other things. Mm-hmm. They're driven by changes in ocean currents, by changes in weather patterns with jet streams and things, which are affected by climate change, but we're still going to get those variations. We're still going to get hot years, and we're still going to get dry years and cooler and wetter years.
Right.
That's still going to happen. It's just that we're going to get more and more hot years rather than cold ones, and more extremes of these kinds. But I wouldn't look into a particular year as evidence of any kind related to climate change.
This is kind of going off a bit off topic where I wanted to go, but it kind of strikes me this is kind of where the advocacy part of it kind of goes off the rails a bit, because I think people are typically very short-term thinking. This is not a short-term matter. This isn't a look at this storm, look at this drought, look at this fire. That's climate change. You have to cast a wider gaze.
There is a tendency for people to say that, especially those already convinced and come up against the naysayers.
Right.
But I don't believe that a particular drought or a particular storm or even two or three of them is evidence of climate change. The evidence for climate change is compelling, overwhelming,
mm-hmm.
but that's not it. What it does tell us is that with climate change, not only do you get long-term change in temperature, long-term change in average conditions, decade by decade retreat of glaciers, decade by decade warming of the oceans, all of those things are happening. And in addition, you will get some changes in these extremes. It's simply known from the physics of climate and weather, and it's now the evidence is coming through as well.
Mm-hmm. One of your topics of interest is how it's climate change will change the ways we live. And I think one of the things we saw that and currently seeing with Harvey is in the Houston area in particular, where there's all these chemical plants. And now the concern isn't just the flood water and people recovering and repairing their homes and resettling. It's 'cause there's great concern about what's in the flood water in terms of, the chemicals. There was a plant that exploded, too. What's the concern there? Because it also reminded me of the whole thing of Fukushima. And I know it was an earthquake, which was a naturally created event. But it seems like one of the things that will have to be dealt with is that we have petrochemical plants and oil refineries and all these places that are easily combustible along these storm areas that are getting more powerful. And, it's not just the storms that people have to worry about.
I'd respond to your observation more generally by saying that a lot of the impacts of changing climate and the extremes that come with them have not been expected.
Right.
My work here at Guelph started off as assessing the impacts of climate change on food production.
Mm-hmm.
And we made some very simplistic assumptions, longer growing season, more heat, maybe changes in moisture, and there'd be some opportunities for agriculture. And that's still the case. Mm-hmm. There are some opportunities. But we also recognized that there'd be some risks associated with that, such as drought. Now, the things that we didn't address at that time, which are now become evident, are all sorts of the other things, like extreme hail being more prominent, or insects and fungi,
right,
that thrive in the conditions that we didn't know about, or something like the Niagara ice wine industry, which is a major industry in Canada, and it's getting fewer days cold enough to harvest ice wine, and they're becoming later in the season, so they're losing crop. So we never expected that. So one of the things about climate change is that the impacts are very difficult to predict, other than the obvious ones. We can predict sea level rise. We can, slowly it grows. We can predict depletion of glaciers, loss of permafrost. Yeah, all of those things are very easy to predict. We never even predicted very well the pine beetle in British Columbia forests.
Right.
People thought, well, more benign temperature, maybe the forest will increase in growth, and that'll be a benefit for the forest industry. What happened? The pine beetle which has always been there,
mm-hmm.
but with the warming climate, it was able to expand like you wouldn't believe.
Freed the beast.
It's damaged, killed like 80% of British Columbia's forest. And now it's gone over the Rockies into Alberta.
Mm.
So here's a little beetle, just a little bit sensitive, that can benefit from this climate, causing huge devastation, not only to the ecosystem, but to the industry. And a lot of those towns, Prince George and many of those towns in British Columbia, had just adjusted to a sustainable management regime where they were planting about the same rate as they were harvesting.
Right.
That's all gone out the window. They've had to harvest these trees before they rot.
Mm.
And so there's been a big boom in pulp preparation. And now some of those communities are dying because there's no trees. So that was very hard to predict. I mean, in hindsight, we should have been able to predict that.
Right.
But dozens and dozens of things. Human health, West Nile virus.
Mm.
Who would have thought that we're going to get an expansion of West Nile virus because the climate becomes more benign in a place like Ontario? So there's dozens and dozens of these effects, which we're now identifying. And we only had a vague idea might occur back in the day when we were trying to estimate the impacts of a forthcoming climate change.
It does make me wonder, given all the research and all the observations made so far, is the problem worse than we thought, or is it going to get worse than we think?
Oh, I think we've grossly underestimated the impacts of climate change. And in part, that's because most of the scientists are very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, scientists rarely...
Which is ironic, given what we're talking about.
And the major scientific reviews of climate change, like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is extremely conservative. The review process of that is way more rigorous than any journal article. It goes to countries. Any country can say, oh, we don't like that statement. And it comes back to the authors, and they either have to justify it or modify it. So the pronouncements from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change have grossly underestimated the changes. I mean, a few years back, there was a statement in there about Himalayan glaciers disappearing by the year 2030 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all hell broke loose. All of the climate change deniers said, well, that can't be wrong. Therefore, the whole exercise is faulty.
Right.
Now, look at any of the glaciers worldwide. They've all depleted. Some of them have disappeared altogether. In the Andes, there are communities that relied on glacier water for their livelihoods. They're done. African glaciers. Glaciers in Canada. Look at the drive up the Athabasca Highway. Look at the Columbia Ice Field. The stakes in the ground of where it was 20, 40, 50 years ago. It's about 4 kilometers back.
Mm-hmm.
The evidence is overwhelming that these things are happening, and yet the assessments by the scientists have been conservative, but even those have been targeted by those industries and those sectors who don't want to hear this truth.
I understand why a scientist doesn't want to engage in chicken littleism, but I think it almost feels like we need a bit of that. We need some scientists to run around saying the sky is falling. And if it turns out not to be true, we get a healthier environment out of it, and I don't understand why anyone would be necessarily against that.
Well, that's not for scientists to
right.
You know, there are people who have been advocates. The Al Gores, for example,
sure.
who take most of the scientific information and put it and work it in a way that might be more appealing to the public than the conventional scientific piece of work. And a lot of scientists speak of their work, but it's hard to put it in plain language because there are so many caveats, you know, especially when we're looking into the future.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some scientists have done that. And of course, they'll be targeted for doing so. This
right.
guy Hansen in the U.S.,
right.
one of the top climate scientists, is targeted by those who don't like his message simply because he's speaking the truth.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to the science, the human cost too, because the other interesting thing about Houston is that 25,000 people there were resettled after Katrina. So it's unscientific to say, but I'm sure a lot of them feel like, you know, to be one place 10 years ago and to be another place today and sort of being chased by the same thing. And I wonder, if we're going to see more of that in the future, as we're going to, you know, we see these storms strike, they see the intensity go up, you know, places flood, people have to move further inland. And I'm not sure if this is the official term, but I'm thinking, you know, when are we going to start seeing maybe a permanent class of climate refugees?
Well, the climate refugee term has been in vogue for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And in some of our work was actually, we didn't use that term, but we were looking at communities that was especially vulnerable to especially things like drought. So in Sahel and in Africa, you have drought.
Right.
And of course, drought is not, and the human displacement because of drought is not just because of dry conditions.
Mm-hmm.
It's also because of the political and cultural and economic circumstances that make people especially vulnerable. So the droughts in the Sahel that caused millions of people to be displaced and die were not of greater magnitude than the droughts that hit North America around the same time. But in North America, we have our institutions to accommodate that a little. We have crop insurance, we have social safety net programs, and so forth. And in a way, they help, but they can also make it worse. I mean, a classic example would be the Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when there's a lot of extra water, the dikes that keep the Mississippi within its floodplain, within its route, they work to an extent, but they also give people the confidence that they can live right up to the edge.
Right.
They call, you know, it's a confidence that really well founded only up to a limit, because when the dike breaches, of course, there's catastrophe. Many more people are hurt and property damage occurs. So I think one of the lessons that seems to be coming home in these latest experiences of Katrina and Houston, and I hear it now, is that people are saying, look, we've got to plan our cities, our occupants, so that we're resilient, so that we recognize that these things are going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And simply putting a big dike or a dam is not necessarily the best way of doing it.
Right.
So I heard a commentator the other day talking about trying to plan cities so that they have absorptive capacity, so that when water comes down, instead of just piling on top of the asphalt, it actually has a place to go. And there are many examples of that around the world where cities or settlements have been planned. But nonetheless, we will find communities that will have to be relocated because of the changing conditions. Either that's because of recurring drought or storm surges and sea level. And so the UN is already recognizing environmental refugees.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that's going to continue.
And even places like the Pentagon, the CIA, recognize it could be a national security problem for the United States in the future.
Here at Guelph, a colleague, Robert McClemon, and I had a contract with CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, to assess the security implications of climate change-induced movement of people around the world. And of course, in many parts of the world, that's the case. So yes, some at the highest level of security agencies, they're aware that these could contribute to issues related to conflict. And of course, there are huge conflicts around the world over water and access to property that'll be compounded by a changing climate.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, you know, we have our institutions, as you said, who are taking this seriously as a problem that needs to be solved, or at least needs to be sort of, you know, to use a Pentagon term, war gamed out. But on the personal, on the individual level, you know, we're still struggling. And you talked about, you know, reorganizing cities and infrastructure to address it. And that's a hard sell, because, you know, bridges in different cities are falling apart, and we can't even rally the people and the money to just fix a bridge.
Yeah, I don't think you have to have a separate program to adapt to climate change.
Right.
What you have to do is just in the things you're doing anyway. If you're rebuilding a road, recognize that the capacity to accommodate storms should be probably a bit different from what you've had in the past. So you make the culverts and what have you bigger or whatever. If you're developing a port or whatever, or a new urban area, be aware that you might get these conditions and factor that into the design. So in our academic language, they call that mainstreaming climate change into your urban management, or even your agricultural stuff. I mean, right. Farmers, of course, have to deal with variable conditions from year to year. And those who say, well, climate change isn't real, I'm not going to factor that in, well, fine, that's their choice. But there are many farmers around the world who are saying, look, I'm going to change my practices to avoid the risks that come with climate change, but sometimes to realize the benefits. There are some opportunities there. So I think if you look at climate change being an issue that society has to deal with, it deals with it in two ways. First, and the key one, is try and reduce our emissions so that we don't continue the change in the climate, because at some point it's going to be very difficult for society to deal with the changing climate. But the other one is, at the same time, do what you can to adapt, to realize that, okay, these storms that we're getting, the Katrina, it's not a once in a lifetime. There may be another one. So when you rebuild or resettle, be aware that maybe it doesn't make any sense to have people rebuild in that spot. That is just so susceptible to flooding and storm surge that it just doesn't make sense. Find a way of having those people live somewhere else. And I believe that there is a recognition of that more and more now. Maybe it takes three experiences in a rich country like the U.S. for that to hit home, because people tend not to want to plan for 10 years hence. But I hear now that people are actually recognizing that, and so I think we're making progress.
The two sort of areas you look at in terms of the effects of climate change, adaptation and mitigation, what's the more likely? What direction are we heading in?
I think we're heading in both. I think that in my time in the field, since about 1980, probably before you were born, I thought that climate change would be an issue for a couple of months and then it would go and it stayed. And then people got very depressed because there didn't seem to be any action on it. And still, people say there's not enough action. There's a lot of talk, but not much. Actually, there's lots of action going on, not necessarily at the international level or at government level.
Right.
But individuals are doing things. Look at the people who now buy energy-efficient cars. People who, when they're buying a house or building a house, build it so it's energy-efficient. Municipalities are doing all sorts of things to reduce their carbon footprint. Businesses are taking it on. Even oil companies are doing it. It's now incorporated into the thinking of many, many people, particularly in rich countries. So we've got a long way to go, but progress has been made. I mean, I can remember during the two terms of George Bush Jr., at first, he said, oh, there's no such thing as climate. Then he said, well, there's climate, but there's no such thing as climate change. Well, yes, there is, but it's not changing much. But, well, okay, it's changing, but it's all natural. And year after year, but there's progression here. Then it was, well, okay, there is a human influence, but it's not much. And okay, yes, there is a human influence on climate change, but the consequences aren't great. Then there was, well, the consequences are great, but to do something about it would cost too much. And then eventually, well, we should be doing something about it anyway. That's all within the mind of one person over a period of 8 years. That's a huge progression. Now, I won't comment on the current incumbent in the U.S. presidency, but my point is that, you know, now someone saying we should do something to reduce our emissions is not considered a nut bar or a tree hugger. That's considered as sensible. Mm-hmm. So I think there is progress being made on the mitigation side. There's huge hurdles to overcome. There are vested interests that are powerful, that try to undermine the science, that try and do all the things that you can to address that. So I think there's progress being made on that side. On the adaptation side, I see action on that. I mean, the federal government's just appointed a panel to try and provide guidance. But adaptation is more what you and I do by our own choice. If we choose to remain vulnerable to the conditions, well, fine. So a lot of that is individual choice or individual businesses or individual communities or organizations. And now the idea of enhancing your resilience, not only to changing climate, but to all sorts of other things, is now being accepted in many, many organizations and households. So I think there's progress there as well.
And once again, that was Barry Smit, and he is an emeritus professor here at the University of Guelph. And I think I timed that just right, because we are running out of time for this week's edition of Open Sources Guelph. James Gordon will be my council guest next week. I hope to confirm a second guest soon because I do not want to do this show alone. so that's another shout out to Scotty Hertz, who will still be on vacation next week. In the meantime, opensourcesguelph.com, opensourcesnewswire, at @OS_Guelph. Those are our social media feeds on the web, Facebook, and Twitter. And of course, you can find this and other episodes of the show on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, whichever app you like to listen to the best. I will be back next week with another edition of End Credits. That's the movie reviews and news show. And otherwise, you can find me at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. Stay tuned for DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And on behalf of Nessie Hunting, Scotty Hertz, I'll see you next week.